From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Superstar violinist Hilary Hahn was young and a master of the classics, Bach and more, when she decided she wanted something new. Hahn loved playing the violin concertos of the greats, but when it came time for the encore, she wanted to branch out. She went to Google, hunted down 27 composers, asked for their help, their minds for new music, new encores. This hour, On Point violinist Hilary Hahn and her 27 new encores, the sound of a new day. You can join us on air or online where this conversation is always on. Violin fans, aficionados, what does Hilary Hahn stand for to you, and what do you hear in her music, this new music? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 800-423-TALK, or join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at OnPoint Radio. Joining me now is Hilary Hahn, world-renowned violinist, two-time Grammy winner, Emmy winner, Academy Award nominated for her work in film scores. She's been celebrated all over the world, playing the masters solo and with the great symphonies, playing Brahms and Bach, Sibelius and Schoenberg and Stravinsky, and she's performed with folk rockers like Josh Ritter and more. Now she's out with new music and a new album with pianist Corey Smythe. It's called In 27 Pieces, the Hilary Hahn Encores. Hilary Hahn, welcome to On Point. It is wonderful to have you.
Hi, Tom. Thank you. It's great to be here.
You're extraordinary. We're going to hear about that, but help us with the music itself. Most of us are not violinists. What are we listening to right there, Hilary?
We're listening to a piece by a composer named Frangiz Alizadeh. She writes with sort of an Eastern influence, I think, but still also very much in the classical tradition.
Azerbaijani, she is.
Exactly. And I don't think it really matters so much where someone comes from, except it's just very interesting to know.
Yes.
It definitely affects their experiences that they put into the music. So, I mean, these are violin pieces, but they're also pieces for duo. So there are these elements of violin and piano interaction that help expand the possible range of expression. So it's just a really fun project for me to see how these different people write about their times through music.
I mean, here you are, a virtuoso. I'm listening, and would you know immediately that this was an encore rather than a movement in some larger piece? Is it clear from the structure or from what you hear in a few seconds to you?
Not necessarily. I think it's necessary to find words to describe things when you're talking about them.
Yeah.
But those words aren't particularly bound to the music form itself. So, for example, classical music is actually a misnomer because the classical era ended a long time ago.
Right.
But it's just an easy way to refer to the form. But the form covers so much ground. I think that it covers as much as all the other genres combined, but then I'm biased.
Well, we were talking about that before the show, saying, well, this, how can you call it classical? That's a long time ago. And yet it conveys,
true,
when you hear this, it still sounds in the genre somehow, even though it's a long way from Bach.
Exactly. And there are things like that throughout all kinds of art and music. How many times have you heard a person classified as a rock artist say, well, I'm not really rock, or I'm not really folk, I'm kind of, and then they list a combination of four or five things that kind of encompass what they are. And I think with encores, actually there is no such thing as an encore as a form. It's actually a use of a certain length of piece. So a lot of encores are transcriptions of movements of things or dances, or they could be taken out of a larger piece and played on their own, kind of like an aria from an opera. The aria is excerpted and stands alone. But in this case, I wanted people to write things specifically for the encore slot in a program, which is once the whole program is over, then the artist who's been performing comes out on stage if the audience is enthusiastic enough and plays something that the audience isn't expecting because it's not written in advance. And at that point, the purpose of an encore is really to wrap up the performance, wrap up the evening. Mm-hmm. It probably has been a couple of hours of a program. And then you really get to just reflect on the whole program and also be put into a whole separate mental space by this encore. So it's kind of a big role for a piece to play.
We're going to hear a lot
However,
of encores
with all
in this.
With all of these composers, they know what encores they've heard that they've liked. They've seen a lot of encores performed, but they didn't necessarily spend much time writing something that was specifically for that slot. But that said, they can be played in a program as well as short pieces instead of just being put at the end.
We're going to hear a lot of them in this hour, and brand new, which is what fascinates me. I love hearing new composition. But just to give a sense, I mean, with a career like yours from a very young age, encores are something you're very, very familiar with. Washington Post wrote about Hilary Hahn, called her one of the greatest violinists in the world today, can do anything she wants. Listening to Hahn play is to be in the presence, the Washington Post said, of instrumental talent that comes along once in a generation. If that, Hilary, if I may, let's just listen to a bit of one of your bigger pieces before you get to the encore to hear what moves people to sort of stand up like beasts, I think you write somewhere, and call for more. But this was back on your 2001 Grammy-winning album of Stravinsky and Brahms violin concertos. And this is Johannes Brahms' first movement in his concert in D major for violin and orchestra, just as the violin we come in here is about to enter for the first time. On you go. It's absolutely beautiful. The Grammy came for that, the 2001 recording. I mean, you must have had so many encores over the years. I've always been curious. I mean, you call the encore, you say, it's that moment at the end of an emotionally satisfying concert remains with us in a special way, sealing the connection established between performer and listener like a musical goodnight kiss. You have symphony audiences, musical audiences who are connoisseurs listening. Are you a connoisseur of the applause that precedes the encore? Do you judge it? When you walk off stage and are surely listening from just off stage, are you assessing the fervor of the applause that will bring on the encore, Hilary?
Yes, that's a really good question because it's one of the most comical moments backstage sometimes, and no one really sees it. There's sort of a bit of a dance, like, should I go back on stage or not? Are they done or are they not? Because if they finish and you start to walk on stage not realizing, then it's a little awkward. But, that happens. And when that happens, you just own it and you dart back out on stage and be like, here I am.
So.
But as far as playing an encore, people have different expectations of when that will happen, depending on what country you're in. So in the States, I often have to figure out, because people want to hear an encore, but they don't know that if they applaud long enough to have people come out maybe three times instead of once, then that means that they're going to get an encore. So I have to figure out what is too early to play an encore and when they actually do want that. In Europe, they'll go into sort of a rhythmic unison applause. So it sounds like people are just clapping a beat. And then you know that they want an encore. In the States, if they stand up, if they give a standing ovation, that's a really good sign. In Asia, well, in Japan, usually it's a sort of a long, polite-sounding applause with no particular, rhythmic unison or standing up. But then you know that they really appreciated it because it keeps going. And so it's always a bit of a situation where you're gauging it. You've picked an encore, though, that really works with the program so that once you're playing it, it makes perfect sense.
Do you have a prompter backstage, like your cultural interpreter who nods to you and says, oh, yes, this, wherever you're playing and you play everywhere, this is the moment? Or are you just judging it yourself when and if you go back on and give the encore?
Usually the people who work in the hall see this day after day, and they have a pretty good idea. So I'll ask them, should I play something now? Like the guys opening the door for the stage or the conductor who works there all the time. I'll just say, you know, should I go now? And they're like, no, wait one more time. Wait one more time.
Wait for it.
Sure?
Hilary Hahn is a real great. It's such a treat to have her with us today. She's out with a new album. It's all encores, and they are all new. She does a lot more than that. She's mixed it up with musicians of all stripes. Here she is in 2008 sharing the stage with folk rocker Josh Ritter at New York's... Oh, sorry. No, it's not. This is one of her encores, When a Tiger Meets a Rosa Rugosa. We'll talk about that after a short break. You can join us this hour. Violin fans, what does Hilary Hahn stand for in your world? Is she your Jagger, your Beyonce, your Jeff Tweedy? She your violinist? And what do you hear in these encores, this raft of new composition? 800-423-8255, 800-423-TALK. Hilary Hahn, please stand by. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. Tom Ashbrook, this is On Point. We're talking this hour with superstar violinist Hilary Hahn about the art of the encore and a whole lot of brand new music she's performing. Her latest album is In 27 Pieces, the Hilary Hahn Encores, a fair name because she asked for them, called 26 composers and asked for brand new encores, had an online contest for the 27th, and some pretty remarkable music behind us right here, Ford's Farm, Hilary Hahn playing this folk-inspired encore piece written for her by the electronic DJ and Chicago composer Mason Bates. You can join the conversation this hour. Are you ready to move past the old encores, the old chestnuts, to mix up the encore repertoire? And aficionados, do you know Hilary Hahn's sound when you hear it? She's with us. We're at 800-423-8255. 800-423-TALK. And I should clear up, it was, in fact, Paganini's Cantabile with Josh Ritter at New York's Metropolitan Museum as we went out of that last segment. We'll go back and hear When a Tiger Meets a Rosa Rugosa. But here we are right now. And Hilary, we've got callers for you. William in Nashua, New Hampshire is calling. Hi, William. You're on the air with Hilary Hahn.
Yes. Hello, Tom, and hello, Hilary. And it's a brilliant idea to do encores. I think that to have them specially written, that is absolutely incredible. And in terms of what you were saying about Hilary's unique sound, Tom, I think that I first came across Hilary's recordings in, I think it was, with a recording of the Bach Partitas and Sonatas that she did. And it just absolutely hit me that this person really, in terms of the playing of the violin, it was just so absolutely exquisite. The thing, it was almost like a human voice. All of the ornaments, all of the expression was just absolutely incredible. And I thought, this person is going a long way. I mean, that was, I had to look it up online to find out when it was. I think it was in the late 90s. So, you know, you're talking of maybe 16 years ago.
Yeah.
So I'm just blown away by her. That's it.
William, you sound like a good listener. How clear is it? I mean, if I played it blind for you, would you know? Would you say, oh, that's Hilary Hahn?
I think so, really, because it's just the way that she plays. It's almost like recognizing a voice. She plays I think any instrument, I mean, the best instrument is a human voice. And so if you play an instrument, you try and make the instrument sing, and that's exactly what she does with the violin. And I think I would be able to recognize her, I think so. Certainly the partitas, because I've played them over and over again, and I think they're by far the best version I think I've ever heard of them.
Hillary, you've got a fan. Do you buy that? Do you find that people can pick you out of a lineup of players playing blind and know it's you, Hillary?
I used to play a game with my father when we were driving in the car back and forth for my lessons and just in general.
Yeah.
Because we listened to a lot of classical radio when I was growing up, and we didn't have a TV, so radio was a big thing. And so we would always try to guess who was playing, because you tune into the middle of a performance or a recording and you just don't even know who it is. So we found eventually we could tell who was who. And one thing to keep in mind with classical music is that although it's written down, it doesn't mean that everything about the music is written down. Mm-hmm. Actually, what is in the score is a map of the structure of the music in relative terms. Mm-hmm. So this note is approximately this much higher than that note, approximately this much longer than that note, or this much louder. But the actual details of all of it can be greatly moved around by the player. And in addition to that, you have things like how they create the tone and how they ornament the vibrato, the sort of wavering sound on a long note that mm-hmm. changes mm-hmm. the pitch a little. So all of those things are quite variable when you put them together. And it's just like when you have like four or five different actors reading the same line, you can probably identify who's who by the inflections of their voice and the rhythms of their speech.
So does that different sound come down then to technique, interpretation, physique, the way your hands and shoulder and chin are shaped, down to even character, your character as a person?
Absolutely. I think technique is what makes everything come across. Technique is the series of tools you have to express yourself. And so technique is sort of a filter for what you're trying to do. And then as far as your intentions with the music, that has to do with your experiences with music, with life, how you look at personal expression,
yeah.
what you are feeling that day. Also, when you're playing live, the audience feedback that you're getting, just the feeling you're getting from them, whether they're with you or not, or if they're pushing a lot of energy in your direction, or if they're calmer, that definitely, it affects the way that you play almost always in a positive way. It just gives you lots of new creative ideas.
Let's listen to more in the liner notes. You thank, among others, you thank the audiences over the centuries who clapped and shouted like beasts until they got the encores they wanted. You got some encores you wanted. And here, this is from Duyun. This is Shanghai-born New York transplant. New York Times has called Duyun an indie pop diva with an avant-garde edge. Here's her encore piece written for you, When a Tiger Meets a Rosa Rugosa. That's beautiful. I have to say, Hillary, on the show we have had the Tuvan throat singers, who I just love.
Ooh.
And there you are with that kind of...
That's definitely an influence.
Yes, I hear those. How do you create that? Those two notes at once. I would always ask them with their vocal cords how they did it. How do you do it with the violin, those double notes?
It's interesting. A composer who knows how to write what they have in mind will write that technique into the music. And in this case, it was more of a feeling than a technique. I wanted to create a tone quality. But the violin is capable of so many things. And Duyun actually wrote a very free score with lots of room for interpretation, but with the right things indicated technically to make that effect happen. I couldn't really say what it is that you do mm-hmm. to make it happen. It's more a combination of sounds that helps to create those overtones and undertones.
It's absolutely beautiful. Mike in Kansas City, Kansas. Mike, you're on the air. Thanks for calling. Hello, Mike. Are you there, my friend?
Hi, Tom. How are you doing?
I'm well. I thought you were lost in the music, and you might have been. What do you think, Mike?
Well, I would. I've flown all over the country to see Hillary. I saw her in Fort Worth in 2008, and just last year I flew to Tampa to see her. She complimented me on my bow tie after the show. I would recognize Hillary's Bach anywhere. Bach is like, I view it almost like a fingerprint for violinists. You know, other pieces that can get lost in the orchestra, but mm-hmm. her Bach and particularly her E minor Chaconne is absolutely incredible. I actually cried when she played it in Tampa.
Recognize anywhere the Bach, and I think Hillary, you've said you play Bach every day and have since you were, I don't know, 4 years old.
Yes, it's a, well, the particular Bach that people are referring to usually when they talk about Bach for violin, mm-hmm. and especially this sort of fingerprint element of Bach, is the solo sonatas and partitas that Bach wrote that really didn't come into concert favor for quite a while. It was about half of its life ago that it began being played live, and people viewed them as more like exercises before that. So it's remarkable that they're so defining now. But basically, the reason that they show a person's musical personality so well is that there are very few indications in the music. There are the notes in the rhythm and some places where it says loud or soft. Mm. But other than that, and a few like tempo guidance markings, like the character, like allegro or something like that. Mm-hmm. Aside from that, it's really just up to the performer. So you have even more variables for the performer to play with in the interpretation. Also, because it's solo, but polyphonic. Polyphonic means it has multiple voices going at one time, and a mm-hmm. voice is really like a melody or mm-hmm. A line that you could hum, just a series of notes, one after the other, in yeah. a single line. So on solo violin, you're playing up to four of these voices at the same time. So then you have this added dimension of how you balance those voices. And what I like to do is I will do opposite things with two voices at once. For example, I'll do a crescendo on one and a decrescendo on the other, so the one gets louder and then the second one gets softer, so that it sounds like two different instruments playing. And it's just really fun to experiment with those things. It changes every single day. I mean, every time I play something by Bach, I think I must have explored all of the options already. And then on stage, I get some new idea and I kind of run with it. So that's really fun. But you do the same with all different repertoire. It's just very, very clear in the Bach because it's so exposed.
Mike, in Kansas City, if Bach is bedrock here, what do you think of Hillary playing these brand new pieces? How's it hit your ear, Mike? Would you fly for them?
I absolutely would. And I'm a pilot by trade, so I can get
there. You go.
Good.
Her. But yeah, it's I'm very, very excited about the new pieces. You know, seeing her play is just incredible. And not to belabor the Bach, but you know, as a I do Scottish fiddle, and I have to say it's absolutely unfair just how easy she makes the Bach look. My fingers cramp up just attempting it. But truly elegant and moved me to tears.
We're glad to have your hands on the stick, I guess you say, in the plane there, Mike, and this kind of music in your ear. Thank you very much for calling. I want to hear more of this new music. 26 pieces, I guess, commissioned, you'd say. The 27th was chosen through an online contest, 400 entrants. And out of those, Hillary Hahn chose to put on this piece called The Angry Birds of Kauai. Came from Hawaii-based composer Jeff Myers. Thank you. Angry Birds of Kauai, Jeff Myers. You listened to 399 others or something like that, Hillary, and chose this one. What leapt out at you as a violinist, as a musician, that said, here, this one?
That's a really good question. When I was listening to music by lots and lots of composers to figure out who I wanted to approach for this particular project in the commissioning process, I actually wasn't sure how I should pick, and I realized I had to listen to my gut instinct. If I heard something that I really wanted to work on closer, then I knew that I had to keep that composer in mind. And it was sort of a feeling that I have to work with this person. And in listening to the entries for the contest, it was kind of an opposite process because the piece was done, but it was a blind contest. So I didn't know who had written it. And I also didn't know what it was called. So I was just basing my decision on that particular piece.
Yeah.
And I found that what worked best for me was thinking about the whole project, the pieces I'd received already, what would offset those pieces well. And another thing I was curious about at that time that still is very interesting to me is this concept of polyphony, which I mentioned earlier in relation to Bach.
Yes.
But in this case, in a duo form. So often when there is something for violin and piano, the composer has to make a choice whether the piano is going to simply accompany or is going to be an active participant in the musical exchange. And this piece actually has very equal lines between the violin and the piano. They take turns and they overlap, interweave. I just found that fascinating. I was curious to work on that a lot more. So that was probably one of the biggest deciding factors. But I also just loved the piece, and that's very important as well.
I'm not sure I'm visualizing beautiful Kauai in the Hawaiian Islands, but maybe. I could certainly hear Angry Birds in there. Boy, that makes the choice of pianist incredibly important when you're going to have a piece like that, that you're, it's not really accompaniment, it's a partner, fully partner.
Yes, Corey is fantastic, and I'm so glad that I got to work with him on this project in particular, but we also just like working together in general. But he does a lot of contemporary music, and one thing that I was not expecting going into this project was how many different musical voices I would wind up experiencing from the composers. I kind of figured there are certain styles, but I just hadn't really thought about all of the different personalities, because every composer brings a separate set of influences, a separate musical language to the table, and then that language is interpreted for that particular piece. So it was really important with Corey to be able to work together on finding how we wanted to give each piece its own individual interpretation instead of painting everything with the same brush.
I mean, I read you said you went on Google to find these composers, which means I assume that you did not even know the work of some of them. You must have read laudatory things about them and invited them on that basis, or did you listen to all of their earlier work before you asked them to create a new encore for you?
More of the latter. Mm-hmm. I actually wanted to learn as much about who was writing as I could, because as a performer, I usually am exposed to just a few pieces per program, especially when I'm playing with orchestra. There will be an overture and then the concerto, which I play, and then a symphony. Often orchestras don't program symphonies by contemporary composers, but they'll program an overture by a contemporary composer. However, I'm warming up at that time, so I don't always, I hardly ever get to experience these new pieces from the concert hall. So I wanted to just really focus on everything I could find. And in the course of that, I spent hours and hours and hours, you know, night after night for months, just listening to everything that I could find. It was so exciting.
Hillary Hahn is with us, violinist extraordinaire, prodigy, and then virtuoso. She has brought out 27 new pieces. The Hillary Hahn Encores, the album is in 27 pieces. Hillary Hahn, please stand by. Listeners, please join us. What do you think? Does this new music, this new frontier, win your applause, your encore? 800-423-8255. Here's from the album Echo Dash from collaborator, composer, Pulitzer Prize winner, I think, Jennifer Higdon. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour with superstar, really superstar, violinist Hilary Hahn. We've been talking about Bach. There's some behind us right now. J.S. Bach's first movement in his Partita No. 3 in E major. She was just 18 when this album came out, this recording. Her latest is in 27 pieces, the Hilary Hahn Encores, 27 encores, all of them brand new music, and we're going to hear more in just a moment. You can join us. What's your question for our intrepid violinist, Hilary Hahn? And what do you hear in the new? Is it as good as the old? Is it great? 800-423-8255 is our number. 800-423-TALK. Michelle is calling from Boston. Hi, Michelle. You're on the air with Hilary Hahn.
Hi, Tom. Hi, Hilary. Wow, this is amazing. Hilary, you have been part of my life and my daughter's life since the 90s, since this premiered. We saw you play this in Seattle, and you inspired a new violinist, and she's still playing. And it's amazing to hear you on the radio today.
Oh.
I can't wait to go and buy this. Chloe and I followed you all up and down the West Coast and ended up moving to Boston for her to play in Boston. And inspiring her. She went to see you in Seattle a couple months back, and she was thrilled to see you again. And I just can't thank you enough. And it's so great that you've done this whole collection of encores, because it was encores for us that were so inspiring. Watching you come out on stage, I can almost still remember the dress. I think it was red. And my little five-year-old girl sitting beside me watching you play this all by yourself was life-changing. So thank you.
Thank you.
That's beautiful. Thank you, Michelle. And good luck to your daughter. Good luck to Chloe, still playing in Seattle. That's wonderful. You started so young yourself, Hilary. Do you have a sense of who gets the bug? I mean, Michelle's daughter heard you, and that was it. And she's still playing violin all these years later. You started so early, and it clearly is it just the exposure, or is there a mindset or a type of mind person who is going to fall for the beauty of this kind of music?
I don't know that. It's hard to say. It's kind of one of these questions of whether it's nature versus nurture in a way, not so purely delineated, mm-hmm. because
right.
there's I've seen it happen in different ways for different people. Like I know a violinist who's incredibly accomplished, who started at 12, which is actually still manageable, but a lot of people start at 4 or 5. So mm-hmm. he started at 12 and then made progress really quickly, and before that just didn't have the bug. And I've seen people start very young and decide not to go into music, but music is, you know, in their life for forever. And then other people, they just beg at the age of 2 to have a violin. And I just came into it by coincidence. But I think however you come to it, it helps to have a really good teacher that you gel with, not someone who's a big name in particular, but mm-hmm. someone who really gets you as a student and who you look up to as a teacher, who inspires you to keep working week after week. And then also just some kind of reason to be dedicated to it. That can come from any corner, but it's not so easy to keep studying something week after week that has infinite room for improvement. On
yeah.
the one hand, it's exciting, and on the other hand, it seems like
daunting.
You'll never attain what you want to attain. So I actually was talking with a teacher after a concert once, and she said she never lets her students quit when they're having a bad time, but they're free to decide to quit when things are going well, and then they never wind up quitting. Because it's really fun to make progress in music. You feel like your vocabulary is opening up, like you're gaining this whole realm of expression and personal range that you didn't have before. It's incredibly liberating. So I think as long as the person studying has that positive personal feedback, then there's a lot of promise there.
Reminds me of that old country song line, "Someday when things are good, I'm going to leave you." I hope you never do. Let's hear more of the new.
Yes.
This is 133 at least. This is from James Newton Howard, of course, well-known for a big soundtrack work. But here, an encore for Hilary Hahn, 133 at least. beautiful. 133 at least. James Newton Howard. Were you just sick of the old encores? I mean, they have been played and played and played and played. Are you tired of them or simply restless for new, Hillary?
You know, I actually love the old encores. I love playing them, and I was very happy to keep playing them for the rest of my career. There are really quite a few, and when you think about it, they became popular at a time when recordings were limited in length. People didn't always play encores that weren't part of their program already. There was a tendency earlier for the audience to applaud at length when they liked something in the middle of a performance, and then you couldn't go on until you repeated that part again. Because, of course, people didn't have recordings to play it back. So if they were going to hear it again, they had to hear it right then.
Yeah.
And then as programming developed over the centuries, people wound up picking certain pieces to play as special treats after the concert that may not have been included on the program. And then recording came along. So the first pop songs, in a way, in classical music were these short pieces. Some of them were written originally at that time, and some of them were transcriptions of already popular works for that particular instrumentation. But when I was thinking about the collections of encores that are out there, I realized there was no focus on the new works. And it's very important for, for music history to be dry about it, but also for artistic development and expression to have things that represent all eras and all opinions, all experiences over the decades, over the generations. And there was this gap. And I felt like we need to have favorites for tomorrow that say what happens today and that really express these things that are so poignant in our lives right now. So it was more just a continuity thing. And I wanted people to think about writing new encores. I was just curious what would come out of it.
Do you think these will have the kind of meaning in the future that the original classics now have to us from the past? And I think a lot of at least casual music listeners, or you know, semi-serious about classical music, often think of the great classical numbers and composers as the greats, and the new stuff is kind of interesting messing around. And I'm sure that's not fair at all, but you must know what I'm talking about. I mean, just look at what symphonies play. So
I know. It's a dilemma because there's this tendency to categorize, to say that new music is this kind of music and older music is this kind of music. Mm. But what I like to do is I play pieces from all different eras, different styles, and I like to mix it up. I don't tend to specialize exclusively. Even when I was premiering this project, I did it in the course of recital programs that had pieces from as far back as the 1600s. And the reason I do that is because, to me, the repertoire that's written in different time periods is actually more timeless than you would think, because for the violin, at least, there are no words. So you can take the ideas that, I mean, in human nature, we share a lot of ideas over time. We share a lot of the same struggles, a lot of the same sources for joy, but they're in different contexts. So you can actually relate to emotions even if they were written a long time ago. Mm-hmm. You just apply them to your day and have a different experience with them every single day. But in this case, I feel like the new music is equally important, and it's not about when it's written. It's about how it speaks to you. And I like to think of older pieces as if they were written new and I'd never heard them before. And when you think about it that way, you take out the traditions, you take out your expectations. A lot of them are quite bizarre, even if they're big, great, well-known classics. And when you think of it that way, it makes them even more intriguing. It opens up options of interpretation, and it makes you realize that a lot of mass opinion is very subjective to the things that we're used to right now.
Yeah, so but knowing all of that old work, and now looking at this new work, you're smart as can be. Step back. Have we changed emotionally? Is there a different emotional profile that emerges over the whole of your couple of dozen encores? You know a lot more new composition as well. Can you look and say, oh, here's the evolution of the human emotional profile over the last 400 years?
I think that's for a scientist to say. I tend to want to relate to everything as best I can because as a performer, my role is to communicate the music to the audience. So I always try to find the common ground. So it's kind of, that even is a very subjective attempt. I think everyone could find a storyline in the music over the eras, and everyone can reach their own conclusion. That's one thing I really love about classical music. It really does not tell you who you're supposed to be depending on who you prefer to listen to. Whereas in a lot of newer genres, it says a lot about you, you know, what performers and what composers you like. In classical music, you can mash together a whole bunch of different composers that you like to listen to, and that's you as a listener. So that's really a fantastic thing about classical music that I love also as a player.
Charles in Lexington, Kentucky. Charles, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call. Mm-hmm. First, I'd like to start off and say what a pleasure it is to get the chance to speak with Ms. Hahn. I really appreciate your work, and I'm a big fan. My question pertains to your ability to connect with the music and to best express yourself. I'm wondering if you have a favorite piece that at the end of the day, after doing your work on pieces that you'll be performing, do you have a go-to piece that you feel you can always connect best with to relieve the stresses of your job? And secondly, I was wondering if you've ever attempted to pick up another instrument that maybe you find that there is, even after playing violin for so long, is there a gap that you feel that you still can't express yourself all the way? And if you've ever pursued to fulfill that void. So with that being said, I appreciate it. I'll take myself off.
Great. Wonderful. Maybe most comforting and most challenging. I don't know. More subtle than that. But what do you say, Hillary?
It's funny. As a person who plays music not as a recreational occupation, but rather as a very concrete focal point of my life, it's hard for me to just play something to chill out because I'm listening so carefully to everything that I'm doing. And when I'm playing, I'm really getting into the depth of the music. So usually whatever I'm working on is both a challenge and a catharsis. When I'm performing any piece, I find an outlet and a release in it. And that element that's a release is different in every concert. That's what I love about playing the same thing in multiple venues, in multiple cities, for a different audience every day. I learn so much about the music and appreciate it so much more for that combination of experiences. So actually, I'm looking for that in everything that I play. And what feels really good at the end of the day is learning something new about something that I thought I knew about already. So I think I can find it in anything, and that's really fun. And as far as other instruments that I've played, I haven't really been successful at other instruments. Mm. I took piano for a while, and what I loved about piano was it was just fascinating to me as a violinist because tonal production on violin is so complex. There are so many aspects to just making the sound start. And on piano, even as a not very accomplished player, you can get a decent sound out of it. You know, a professional would have a whole different opinion on that. Mm-hmm. But you can press a key, and at a certain moment, the sound starts.
Yes.
It's just miraculous. And you can feel, if you do it slowly, you can feel the moment in which the hammer hits the string.
Yeah.
And I always loved that tactile response because it was so honest.
The certainty of it.
Yes, absolutely.
The violin a little different. You know, you have such a marvelous intellect, and I know from your tweeting or your violin case tweeting, at violin case, a sense of humor as well. Do you flip a switch when you go to music into a different mindset, or are you bringing the same intellect that you're articulating with us here straight into the music? Is it a different frame of mind or one continent?
There's a lot of thinking that goes into playing. There's always some part of what I'm working on chugging away in the back of my mind almost without me knowing it. So it's like if I turn up the volume, I hear what it is. And if I don't pay attention to it, it doesn't distract me. But there's just this constant thinking about music, so that when you actually play, you go into a combination of conscious and subconscious. For me, that's kind of a meditative state, so it may look like I'm very serious sometimes when I'm playing, but that's that meditative aspect taking over.
Hilary Hahn, you are a marvel. The clock is upon us, and I wish it weren't.
Okay.
I could spend all day, but it's just terrific, terrific to have you. Such a wonder and a wonderful thing. All these new encores have come about because of your initiative. The album is in 27 pieces, the Hilary Hahn Encores. Here's the piece you go out with there, Mercy, from British composer Max Richter. Hilary Hahn, superstar, thank you very much for being with us today. Just wonderful. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Listeners, thanks for joining us. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.